flown, I have sailed. I have moved about this world of ours, and ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in Spine Chillers.
You are listening to Radio Masterpieces on Valley 104.9, serving Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge.
No business like show business, like no business I know.
No business like it, everything about it is appealing.
Why, it's grand.
Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling.
You're a smash.
When you are stealing that extra bow.
There's no people like show people, they smile when they are low.
Even with a turkey that you know will fold,
you may be stranded out in the cold.
Still you wouldn't change it for a stack of gold. Let's go on with the show.
The butcher and the baker and the grocer and the clerk
are secretly unhappy men because
the butcher and the baker and the grocer and the clerk
get paid for what they do but no applause.
They'd gladly bid their dreary jobs goodbye for anything theatrical and why.
Because there's no business like show business, like no business I know.
You get word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. On top of that, your pa and ma have parted. You're brokenhearted, but you go on.
Good boy.
There's no people like show people. They don't run out of dough.
Yesterday they told you you would not go far.
That night you open and there you are.
Next day on your dressing room they've hung the star. Let's go on with the show. People like show people, they smile when they are low, 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 low.
Angels come from everywhere with lots of jack,
and when you lose it, there's no attack.
Where could you get money that you don't give back?
Let's go on with the show right now. Let's go on with the show.
This is Bruce Kaplan welcoming you back to another episode of Radio Masterpieces on the great little station, Valley 104.9. Thank you so much for tuning in. We have some wonderful gems for you tonight. We begin with a great episode from Suspense starring the fantastic actor Orson Welles. And then we continue on with a really spooky program of Inner Sanctum. If you want to listen to our programs at other times, just go to Radio Masterpieces on Google and you'll come right to my programs because of our wonderful engineer, Kevin Crutchfield, and he has posted the program so you can listen on a podcast at your leisure. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to write to me at bruce@radiomasterpieces.com, and I'll be sure and get back to you. Well, now let's enjoy our fantastic shows. Thanks again for tuning in.
The Columbia Network takes pleasure in bringing you Suspense. The Hitchhiker.
Thank you. Route 66, just west of Gallup, New Mexico. If I tell it, perhaps it'll help me. Keep me from going crazy. I gotta tell this quickly. I'm not crazy now. I feel perfectly well, except that I'm running a slight temperature. My name is Ronald Adams. I'm 36 years of age, unmarried, tall, dark, with a black mustache. I drive a 1940 Buick, license number 6Y175189. I was born in Brooklyn. All this I know. I know that I'm at this moment perfectly sane. That it's not me who's gone mad. It's something else. Something utterly beyond my control. I've got to speak quickly. At any minute, the link may break. This may be the last thing I ever tell on Earth. The last night I ever see the stars. 6 days ago, I left Brooklyn to drive to California.
Goodbye, son. Good luck to you, my boy.
Goodbye, Mother. Here, give me a kiss, and I'll go.
I'll come out with you to the car.
Oh, no, it's raining. Stay here at the door. Hey, what's this? Tears? I thought you'd promised me you wouldn't cry.
Oh, I know, dear. I'm sorry. But I do hate to see
Mother,
you.
Go. I'll be back. It'll only be on the coast 3 months.
Oh, it isn't that. It's just the trip. Ronald, I wish you weren't driving.
Oh, Mother, there you go again. People do it every day.
I know, but you'll be careful, won't you? Promise me you'll be extra careful. Don't fall asleep. Or drive fast, or pick up any strangers on the road.
Oh, gosh. I think I was still 17 here, you two.
Oh. And why? I mean, as soon as you get to Hollywood, won't you, son?
Of course I will. Don't you worry. There's nothing going to happen. It's just 8 days of perfectly simple driving on smooth, decent, civilized roads. With a hot dog or a hamburger stand every 10 miles. I was in fine spirits. The drive ahead of me, even the loneliness, seemed like a lark. I reckoned without him. Crossing Brooklyn Bridge that morning in the rain, I saw a man leaning against the cables. He seemed to be waiting for a lift. There were spots of fresh rain on his shoulders. He was carrying a cheap overnight bag in one hand. He was thin, nondescript, with a cap pulled down over his eyes. I would have forgotten him completely, except that just an hour later, while crossing the Pulaski Skyway over the Jersey Flats, I saw him again. At least, he looked like the same person. He was standing now with one thumb pointing west. I couldn't figure out how he got there, but I thought probably one of those fast trucks had picked him up, beaten me to the Skyway, and let him off. I didn't stop for him. Then late that night, I saw him again. It's on the new Pennsylvania Turnpike between Harrisburg and Pittsburgh. It's 265 miles long with a very high speed limit. I was just slowing down for one of the tunnels when I saw him, standing under an arc light by the side of the road. I'd seen quite distinctly the bag, the cap, even the spots of fresh rain scattered over his shoulders. He hallooed at me this time.
Hello! Hello!
I stepped on the gas like a shot. That's lonely country through the Alleghenies, and I had no intention of stopping. Besides, the coincidences, or whatever it was, gave it to Willie's. I stopped at the next gas station. Fill her up.
Certainly, sir. Check your oil, sir?
No, thanks.
Nice night, isn't it?
Yes. It hasn't been raining here recently, has it?
Not a drop of rain all week.
Oh? Oh, I suppose that doesn't do your business any harm.
Oh, people drive through here all kinds of weather. Mostly business, you know. There aren't many pleasure cars out on the turnpike this season of the year.
I suppose not. What, What about hitchhikers?
Hitchhikers here?
What's the matter? Don't you ever see any?
Not much. If we did, it'd be a sight for sore eyes.
Why?
Oh, a guy'd be a fool who started out to hitch rides on this road. Look at it.
Then, you've never seen anybody?
Nope. Maybe they get the lift before the turnpike starts. I mean, you know, just before the toll house. But then it'd be a mighty long ride. Most cars wouldn't want to pick up a guy for that long a ride. And you know, this is pretty lonesome country here. Mountains and woods. You ain't seen anybody like that, have you?
No. Oh, no, not at all. It's just a technical question.
I see. Well, that'll be just $1.49 with the tax.
Gradually passed through my mind a sheer coincidence. I had a good night's sleep in Pittsburgh. I didn't think about the man all next day until just outside of Zanesville, Ohio, I saw him again. It was a bright, sunshiny afternoon. The peaceful Ohio fields, brown with the autumn stubble, lay dreaming in the golden light. I was driving slowly, drinking it in, when the road suddenly ended in a detour. In front of the barrier, he was standing. Let me explain about his appearance before I go on. I repeat, there was nothing sinister about him. He was as drab as a mud fence, nor was his attitude menacing. He merely stood there, waiting, almost drooping a little, the cheap overnight bag in his hand. He looked as though he'd been waiting there for hours. Then he looked up. He hailed me. He started to walk forward.
Hello! Hello! Hello?
No, not just now, sorry.
Going to California?
No, not today. The other way, going to New York, sorry. After I got the car back on the road again, I felt like a fool. Yet the thought of picking him up, of having him sit beside me, was somehow unbearable. At the same time, I felt more than ever unspeakably alone. Hour after hour went by. Fields, the towns ticked off one by one. The light changed. I knew now that I was going to see him again. And though I dreaded the sight, I caught myself searching the side of the road, waiting for him to appear.
Yeah, what is it? What do you want?
You sell sandwiches and pop here, don't you?
Yeah, we do in the daytime. But we're closed up now for the night.
I know, but I was wondering if you could possibly have a cup of coffee, black coffee. Just
no, not this time of night, mister. My wife's a cook. She's in bed.
No, don't shut the door, please. Listen, just a minute ago. Just a minute ago, there was a man standing here right beside the stand, a suspicious-looking man. I don't mean to disturb it. You see, I was driving along when I just happened to look, and there he was.
How was he doing?
Well, nothing.
You've been taking a nip, that's what you've been doing. Now, on your way before I call out Sheriff Oates.
I got into the car again and drove on slowly. I was beginning to hate the car. If I could have found a place to stop, to rest a little. I was in the Ozark Mountains of Missouri now. A few resort places there were closed, only an occasional log cabin, seemingly deserted. That's all that broke the monotony of the wild, wooded landscape. I had seen him at that roadside stand. I knew I'd see him again. Maybe at the next turn of the road. I knew that when I saw him next, I would run him down. But I didn't see him again. I didn't see him until late next afternoon. I stopped a car at a sleepy little junction just across the border into Oklahoma to let a train pass by. he appeared across the tracks, leaning against a telephone pole. Perfectly airless, dry day. The red clay of Oklahoma was baking under the southwestern sun. Yet there were spots of fresh rain on his shoulders. I couldn't stand that. Without thinking, blindly, I started the car across the tracks. He didn't look up at me. He was staring at the ground. I stepped on the gas hard, gearing the wheel sharply toward him. I could hear the train in the distance now, but I didn't care then. Something went wrong with the car. The train was coming closer. I could hear its bell ringing and the cry of its whistle. Still, he stood there. And now I knew that he was beckoning me to my death. Frustrated him that time. The starter worked at last. I managed to back up. When the train passed, he was gone. I was all alone in the hot, dry afternoon. After that, I knew I had to do something. I didn't know who this man was or what he wanted of me. I only knew that from now on, I mustn't let myself alone on the road for 1 minute. Hello there. Like a ride?
Well, what do you think? How far are you going?
Where do you want to go?
Amarillo, Texas.
I'll drive you there.
Gee. You mind if I take off my shoes? My dogs are killing me.
Go right ahead.
Gee, what a break this is.
You hitchhike much?
Sure. Only it's tough sometimes in these great open spaces to get the break.
Yeah, I should think it would be, though. I'll bet you get a good pickup in a fast car. If you did, you could get places faster than, say, another person in another car, couldn't you?
I don't get you.
Well, take me, for instance. Suppose I'm driving across the country, say, at a nice steady clip, about 45 miles an hour. Couldn't a girl like you just standing beside the road waiting for Liz beat me to town, or any town, provided she got picked up every time in a car doing from 65 to 70 miles an hour?
I don't know. What difference does it make?
Oh, no difference. It's just a crazy idea I had sitting here in the car.
Imagine spending your time in a swell car thinking of things like that.
What would you do instead?
What would I do? If I was a good-looking fella like yourself, why, I just enjoy myself every minute of the time. I'd sit back and relax. And if I saw a good-looking girl along the side of the road, hey, look out!
Did you see it?
See who?
A man standing beside the barbed wire fence.
I didn't see anybody. There wasn't nothing but a bunch of cows and the wire fence.
No?
What'd you think you was doing? Trying to run into the barbed
wire.
There's
a man there, I tell you. A thin gray man with an overnight bag in his hand. And I was trying to run him down.
Run him down? You mean kill him?
Say you didn't see him back there? You sure?
I didn't see a soul. As far as
I'm
concerned.
Watch for him the next time and keep watching. Keep your eyes peeled on the road. He'll turn up again. Maybe any minute now. There, look there.
How does this door work? I'm getting out of here.
Did you see him that time?
No, I didn't see him that time. And personally, mister, I don't expect never to see him. All I want to do is go on living. I don't see how I will very long driving with you.
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know what came over me, but please don't go.
So if you'll excuse me...
You can't go. Listen, how would you like to go to California? I'll drive you to California.
Seeing pink elephants all the way? No, thanks. Thanks just the same.
Listen, please, just 1 minute, please.
You know what I think you need, big boy? Not a girlfriend. Just a good dose of sweet...
Please.
There. I got it now.
No, you can't go. Please, come
back. Your
hands
off me. Do you hear? Leave your hands off...
She ran from me. As though I were a monster. few minutes later, I saw a passing truck pick her up. I knew then that I was utterly alone. It was in the heart of the great Texas prairies. There wasn't a car on the road after the truck went by. I tried to figure out what to do, how to get hold of myself. If I could find a place to rest, or even if I could sleep right here in the car for a few hours along the side of the road. I was getting my winter overcoat out of the back seat to use as a blanket when I saw him coming toward me, emerging from the herd of moving steer.
Hello!
Maybe I should have spoken to him then. Fought it out then and there. For now he began to be everywhere. Wherever I stopped, even for a moment, for gas, for oil, for a drink of pop, a cup of coffee, sandwich, he was there. I saw him standing outside the auto camp in Amarillo that night when I dared to slow down. He was sitting near the drinking fountain, a little camping spot just inside the border of New Mexico. He was waiting for me outside the Navajo reservation where I stopped to check my tires. I saw him in Albuquerque when I bought 20 gallons of gas. I was afraid to stop now. I began to drive faster and faster. I was in lunar landscape now. The great arid mesa country of New Mexico. I drove through it with the indifference of a fly crawling over the face of the moon. Now he didn't even wait for me to stop. Unless I drove at 85 miles an hour over those endless roads, he waited for me at every other mile. I'd see his figure, shadowless, flitting before me, still in the same attitude, over the cold, lifeless ground, flitting over dried-up rivers, over broken stones cast up by old glacial upheavals, flitting in that pure and cloudless air. I was beside myself when I finally reached Gallup, New Mexico this morning. There's an auto camp here. Cold, almost deserted this time of year. I went inside and asked if there was a telephone. I had the feeling that if only I could speak to someone familiar, someone I loved, I could pull myself together.
Your call, please.
Long distance.
Long distance, certainly. This is long distance.
I'd like to put in a call to my home in Brooklyn, New York. I'm Ronald Adams. The number is Beechwood 200828.
Certainly. I will try to get it for you. Albuquerque. New York for Gallup.
New York.
Gallup, New Mexico, calling Beechwood 200828.
I read somewhere that love could banish demons. It's the middle of the morning. I knew Mother would be home. I pictured her tall and white-haired in her crisp house dress, going about her tasks. Be enough, I thought, just to hear the even calmness of her voice.
Will you please deposit $3.85 for the first 3 minutes? When you have deposited $1.50, will you wait until I have collected the money? All right, deposit another $1.50. Will you please deposit the remaining 85 cents? Ready with Brooklyn. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Mrs. Adams' residence.
Hello, Mother?
This is Mrs. Adams' residence. Who is it you wish to speak to, please?
What? Who's this?
This is Mrs. Winnie.
Mrs. Winnie? I don't know any Mrs. Winnie. Is this Beechwood 208-828?
Yes.
Where's my mother? Where's Mrs. Adams?
Mrs. Adams is not at home. She's still in the hospital.
The hospital?
Yes. Who is this calling, please? Is it a member of the family?
Well, what's she in the hospital for?
She's been prostrated for 5 days. Nervous breakdown. But who is this
nervous
calling?
Nervous breakdown? Well, my mother never was nervous.
It's all taken place since the death of her oldest son, Ronald.
Death of her oldest son, Ronald? Hey, what's this? What number is this?
This is Beechwood 208-828. It's all been very sudden. He was killed just 6 days ago in an automobile accident on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Your 3 minutes are up, sir. Your 3 minutes are up, sir.
And so... So I'm sitting here in this deserted auto camp in Gallup, New Mexico. I'm trying to think. Trying to get hold of myself. Otherwise, I am going to go crazy. Outside, it's night. The vast, soulless night of New Mexico. A million stars are in the sky. Ahead of me stretch 1,000 miles of empty mesa. Mountains. Prairies. Desert. Somewhere among them, he's waiting for me. Somewhere I shall know who he is and who I am.
Dancing the victory polka, and when we've lit the torch of liberty in each blacked-out land across the sea, when a man can proudly say I'm free, we'll be dancing the victory polka,
and we will give a mighty cheer when the ration book is just a souvenir. And we'll heave a mighty sigh when each gal can kiss the boy she kissed goodbye.
And they'll come marching down Fifth Avenue, the United Nations in review. When this lovely dream has all come true, we'll be dancing the victory polka.
Dance, dance, dance the victory polka.
Jine, jine, the merry throng.
Sing, sing, sing the victory polka.
Raise your voices loud and strong.
This gonna be
a great hallelujah day.
When the boys have
all come home to stay. And a million bands begin to play.
We'll be dancing the victory polka.
And when we've lit the torch of liberty
in each blacked out land
across the sea, when a man can proudly say I'm free,
we'll be dancing the victory polka. And we will give a mighty cheer
when a ration book is just a souvenir.
And we'll heave a mighty sigh
when each gal can kiss the boy she kissed goodbye. And they'll come marching down Fifth Avenue, the United Nations in review. When this lovely dream has all come true,
we'll be dancing the victory polka. We'll be dancing the victory polka.
Broadcasting from our Lower Snoqualmie Valley studios, Valley 104.9 FM is KAPY-LP, Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge.
Get ready to hear a gory little story entitled Boomerang. And stars Martin Gable in the role of John Keeler. So, hitch up your chair, switch off the lights, and look out.
Ah! Help, help me. No one heard me. No one came. And in my back there was a kind of numbness. I screamed, "Ah! Help! Help!" But no one answered. I was utterly alone, helpless, watching my life dripping drop by drop to the floor. Then the blackness closed in. When I regained consciousness, two uniformed patrolmen were bending over me, looking frightened and puzzled.
Suicide, Riley?
Either that or murder.
Their voices seemed to come echoing over an aching void. I wanted to tell them how it had happened. I wanted to tell them about Bill Sloan and Helen and the airplane. I was frantic. I had to tell them.
He's trying to say something, Riley.
Poor guy. He can't talk. He's too far gone.
I couldn't talk. My tongue was thick like cotton. My lips moved, but that was all. It was all shut up inside me. They would never know how it had happened.
Riley, it looks to me like murder.
Murder, yes, it was murder. And if only I could have spoken, I would have told them. About my nervous breakdown. About the sanitarium. That's where it began, back there in that plushy prison. I was locked up behind that big wall, and my wife and my partner, they had the chance to discover each other. And then when I came out, the doctor said I was cured. Their false solicitude. And all the while, suspicion was building up inside me. I was already suspicious that day. I caught them by surprise. I'd come directly home from my regular visit to the psychiatrist instead of returning to the office. Bill was there in the living room with Helen. My partner and my wife, laughing together. I closed the front door silently. The rugs muffled my footsteps. I entered the room suddenly, wanting to see their faces when they saw me.
Oh, what, darling?
Hello, Helen.
Why, John, how did you happen to come home in mid-afternoon? Why aren't you at the office?
I was thinking of asking you that question. Bill made some flimsy excuse, but I caught the look of guilt on his face. He was a bachelor, smooth with words, successful with women. And I was beginning to believe he had succeeded with my wife. Oh, I had evidence. There was the time a few nights later. Helen and I were going up to bed. As we passed the umbrella stand at the foot of the stairs, I noticed something. Helen, just a moment. This umbrella, it's Bill's.
Oh, is it?
Yes, it is. What's doing here?
Well, he must have forgotten it when he was over the other day. Take it out of the office in the morning, will you, darling?
I made no reply. We continued up the stairs and went to bed. I waited until Helen was asleep, then crept out of bed and down the stairs. There was the umbrella. I reached out my hand, afraid to touch it, but I had to. The umbrella was still wet. It had rained that afternoon. I said nothing about it the next morning. Oh, I was suspicious enough. But I told myself I had to be absolutely sure. And then
That next night, it happened. Helen went out after dinner, saying she had an appointment with her hairdresser. As the door closed behind her, I picked up the phone and dialed the number.
Hello? Crescent Beauty Salon?
Alberta, this is Mr. John Keeler. I'm calling for my wife to verify her appointment for this evening.
Mrs. Keeler? But, monsieur, she has no appointment for this evening.
Now, I was sure. Bill and Helen were together. I struggled to control my emotions. My head was whirling. I felt ill, weak. My heart was pounding in my chest. The room began to spin. First the floor lamp, then the chairs, finally the table whirling around my head. I needed air, air. I forced myself out of my seat, stumbled across the floor to the window, and threw it open. The stars, too, were spinning, chasing each other in a mad race across the sky. I sucked the fresh air into my lungs, and slowly the stars resumed their normal positions. I drew my head back into the room, and then it struck me across the nostrils. Gas. The room was full of gas. Yes, I found one gas jet open in the kitchen stove. I fought against the logical conclusion, struggled against it all that night and into the next day. But I could no longer stand it by mid-afternoon. That open gas jet last night had been no accident. They were planning to have me put out of the way. Well, two could play at that game. I also could commit murder. I worked out a plan. First, the business trip to Buffalo that I'd been putting off for weeks. I could use that as my alibi. I called my secretary.
Yes, Mr. Keeler.
Miss Jackson, I've decided to go up to Buffalo tomorrow. Could you get me a drawing room on the 5 o'clock train?
I'll call the railroad station right now, Mr. Keeler.
A few minutes later, she called me back. I had the train reservation. So far, so good. I went to the bank, and from the bank to the airline terminal.
What can I do for you, sir?
I want a seat on the Rochester plane. The plane that leaves New York at 9:30 tomorrow night.
9:30. What is the name, sir?
Dunham. Roger Dunham.
Well, you're a lucky man, Mr. Dunham. It's the last seat on the plane.
Roger Dunham. That assumed name would prove my alibi. The details of my scheme were falling into place. I went home, and at dinner told Helen I was leaving for Buffalo tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Must you go tomorrow, John? Can't it wait?
I've been putting this trip off too long already. I'll leave straight from the office and come home the next afternoon.
Well, you're being a little inconsiderate. I'll be all alone here overnight.
Oh, come, Helen. You're not afraid of anything, are you?
Afraid? No, but
well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll ask Bill to come over and keep you company tomorrow night. How'll that be?
Why, that'll be fine.
Another cog in place. Another gear meshed. Now one last piece to move and the engine of my revenge would be complete. Yes, it was revenge now. Revenge for what those two had done to me.
Buffalo, eh? It's a good idea, John. The way your trip could combine business with pleasure.
Pleasure?
You've been rather tense lately. The change of the scene will do you worlds of good.
I'm sure it will. How about Helen? Can you make it tonight?
Tonight? Yes, I'll be over after dinner.
That day passed like a dream. With me, the sleepwalker in the center, going through all the motions correctly, but waiting for the evening. For I wasn't hunted now. Now I was the hunter. A little past 4 o'clock that afternoon, I left the office and took a cab to the station. I went directly to my drawing room, and as the train pulled out, I called for the porter.
At midnight, sir?
Just a glass of milk, porter. Warm milk. And don't bring it before midnight. Till then, I've got a lot of work to do, and I don't want to be disturbed.
Just as you see, sir.
I gave the porter an unnecessarily large tip to make sure he'd remember me. Now, when the train stopped to change engines at Harmon an hour later, it was raining, thunderstorming. I pulled my hat down over my eyes, raised my coat collar around my face, and became just another shadowy figure hurrying to get out of the rain. I crossed the platform unnoticed, and 10 minutes later, I was on a train going southbound, returning to New York. I picked up my car at the parking lot and drove out to my house on the cliff. Parking on a side road, I climbed up the hill on foot. By now, the rain was coming down in sheets. Lightning split the sky and thunder crashed around me. I could see the light from my house perched at the edge of the cliff. Now, Bill's car was parked on the driveway, pointed downhill. Light came from the living room. I crept through the shrubbery to a window. There they were, Bill and Helen. My partner and my wife, sitting side by side on the divan. He drinking my whiskey, comfortable and warm, while I, the unwanted, was standing outside in the storm. How I hated him at that moment. I went back to Bill's car, crept beneath it, and went to work. The sound of the storm covered the noise of my tools as I disconnected the brakes. And I was finished. And none too soon, for suddenly the front door opened, and Bill stood framed in the light of the doorway with Helen behind him.
Bad night for it, but we'll never get another chance like this one, Helen.
Well, all right, but come back quickly, Bill. I'm nervous.
Oh, nothing to be nervous about. John is halfway to Buffalo by now. A perfect opportunity to go over our plans with Bates.
All right, go ahead then. But hurry.
I'll have Bates back here in a jiffy.
Bates. He was going to fetch Bates, undoubtedly a hired killer. I laughed inwardly as the car got started. I could see Helen watching it as it picked up speed on the steep downgrades. Something was wrong now, and she knew it.
Bill, not the car!
Too late, too late. The car was roaring downhill out of control, charging toward the lip of the cliff. There was a crash and smash through the car.
Bill! Bill!
He's dead, Helen.
Oh.
It's a sheer drop of 400 feet to the bottom.
John, I thought... John, you said you were going to Buffalo.
I am going to Buffalo, Helen, after I finish my business here.
Well, Bill, the car just...
It was a pity about the brakes. They must have come disconnected.
Disconnected?
Accidents will happen, Helen.
John, you killed him.
You and Bill thought you had pulled the wool over my eyes. Well, I fooled you.
Stay away from me.
I'm going to throw you over the cliff. I'm going to send you to join your lover.
You can't do that.
Tomorrow they'll find your bodies. They'll think you were thrown clear of the car when it crashed. They'll call it an unfortunate accident.
No, please,
careful,
John.
Helen, you're at the edge. There's nothing behind you.
John, don't touch me! John!
Goodbye, Helen. If I had any feeling at that moment, it was a feeling of satisfaction. I, the failure, had committed the perfect crime. My scheme was flawless. I walked down the hill to my car, changed my clothes, and drove to the airport. As Roger Dunham, I boarded the plane for Rochester at 9:30 that night. Just as I'd planned it, we arrived at that city well ahead of my train. I was waiting when the long line of sleeping cars pulled in at the Rochester station platform. I boarded the train. My drawing room was just as I had left it at Harmon. I sank down in a seat, removed my coat and shoes. I looked at my watch. It was midnight. Come in.
Beg pardon, sir. It's midnight, sir.
Oh, midnight? Really? Oh, thanks for bringing the milk.
It's lukewarm, sir, just like you asked for it.
Thank you, porter. In Buffalo, I went to my usual hotel, checked in, went to sleep. Oddly enough, I slept well that night. A deep, dreamless sleep. In fact, I overslept, for when I wakened, it was broad daylight and the phone was ringing. I struggled out of bed, lifted the receiver. Hello.
This is the long-distance operator. I have a New York City call for Mr. John Keeler.
This is Mr. Keeler speaking.
One moment, please. Here's your party.
Mr. Keeler?
Yes?
This is Miss Jackson. I've just arrived at the office. Mr. Keeler, I don't know how to tell you. The police.
What about the police?
They're here in the office. They want you to return at once.
Miss Keeler, what's going on there?
Mr. Sloan and your wife. Both of them are dead, Mr. Keeler.
Dead?
Mr. Sloan's car went off the cliff near your house last night. The accident was discovered this morning.
Accident? You say it was an accident.
It must have been an accident, Mr. Keeler.
She even thought it was an accident. Now, if only the police thought likewise. I told my secretary I'd take the first plane back to the city, and I hung up. A
few hours later, I reached New York, hurried to my office.
There's a detective waiting in your office, Mr. Keeler.
A detective?
He said he had to see you.
A detective. This was the test. I pulled myself together and opened the door to my office.
Mr. Keeler?
Yes. I understand you're from police headquarters.
Jerome is the name, sir. Assistant Inspector.
How do you do, sir?
We won't take up much of your time, Mr. Keeler. It's an open and shut case.
How do you mean that?
Well, stormy night, slippery road, bad brakes. Obviously an accident. I'm very sorry.
I nodded at the detective, and all the while I was laughing inwardly. He sat there, the very symbol of the law, and offered me official sympathy. No question of clues, nothing overlooked, nothing to fear. Not now. I, the weakling, had committed the perfect crime. Yes, Miss Jackson?
Mr. Keeler, there's a man out here to see you.
Send him away.
He won't go. He says you don't know him, but it's extremely important.
What's his name?
His name is Bates, Mr. Keeler. William Bates.
Bates? The hired killer. I told my secretary I'd see him. I went into the outer office. Bates was sitting on one of the chairs with an open briefcase on his lap. He was a big man, tough looking.
I read the news in the morning paper, Mr. Keeler. Too bad. That was a tough break.
Yes. Yes, it was.
I didn't know if I should go after you now, but... Well, after all, I'm a businessman. My time is money.
I'm sure it is, but why tell me about it? You certainly don't expect me to pay you.
Why not? They're your plans.
My plans?
Well, look at them. Here they are. Why, they've even got your name on them.
I didn't know whether I could trust my ears. Whether I could believe my vision. Bates drew a roll of architectural drawings out of his briefcase and shoved them at me.
Look at them. There it is in your partner's handwriting. Plans for the new Keeler house.
Who are you?
I told you. My name is Bates. I'm a building contractor. Your partner and your wife insisted that the whole job had to be done in secret.
In secret?
They said something about you having just come out of a sanitarium. They wanted the whole thing to be a big surprise.
My mind was reeling. The secret meetings that led me to suspect Bill and Helen. Those meetings were to go over the plans for a house. My house and Helen's. I had killed my best friend and my wife.
Inspector Jerome, I want to confess. I killed them. I killed them.
Killed them? Killed who?
Don't look at me like that. You know who I'm talking about. My partner and my wife. I killed them last night. Now I'm ready to take my punishment.
Well, calm down, Mr. Keeler. You've had a hard time. We realize this thing has been a great shock.
What are you talking about?
The homicide squad doesn't jump to hasty conclusions, Mr. Keeler. We've made a thorough checkup on your background.
What's my background got to do with it?
Well, we know you spent 3 months in a sanatorium recuperating from a nervous collapse. Now, on top of that, this unfortunate accident.
It wasn't an accident. I killed him.
We checked every movement you made since you left the office yesterday.
Then you must know.
We know you took the 5 o'clock train to Buffalo. Porter on your Pullman had no trouble recalling you. Why, he even told us how he brought you a glass of milk at midnight. You were a good 200 miles away from New York when the accident happened.
The detective went away, shaking his head. Sympathetically. My mind was in a turmoil. I had committed the perfect crime, and it had boomeranged. I went home. The house on the cliff was empty. Everywhere I looked, I saw Helen. Her photograph on my desk. Her red-tipped cigarette still in the ashtrays. 2 half-empty cocktail glasses side by side on the living room table. There was desolation in the house. Emptiness. Loneliness. And it would be like this for the rest of my life. But there was one way out. I always kept a loaded gun in the desk. I took it out of the drawer and in my hand. Here was my punishment. This time I couldn't fail. I placed the gun against my chest and pulled the trigger. I fell by the desk and lay there, where I am now, staining the carpet with my blood. I was dying, And I was glad of it. And then I remembered the plane. The plane reservation to Rochester. I could tell the police when they came, and they could check that, and they would know that I was guilty. But they came too late. They bent over me. I tried to tell them. I tried.
Riley, he's trying to say something.
Yeah, cool guy. He's too far gone to talk.
Now I'm lying here on the carpet, waiting to die, with my guilt locked up inside me. I can see a new figure among the police. A man in civilian dress with a small black bag in his hand.
How long is it since this man was discovered in this condition, officer?
About half an hour, Doc.
He's in very bad shape.
Will he live, Doc? Will he recover?
Oh, yes. He may recover, but only partially.
Partially? How do you mean, Doc?
Notice his inability to move so much as a finger. Notice how only his lips move, trying to form words without being able to speak. The bullet must have injured his spinal cord. This man is paralyzed. Totally paralyzed.
So now I know. I'm paralyzed. I'm not going to die. And yet I can see the policemen moving carefully about the room. And I hear them speaking softly as one speaks in the presence of the dead. So I've failed again. For the last time. Because I know my fate now. To live in this living death. Alone with my guilt. Forever. That is my punishment.
Seldom shines up in Seattle. All the whistles go and the bells go, and the ferry boats are chugging right along, right along.
All the people love to ride the Blue Pacific on the Black Ball Ferry Line, to be specific.
While the whistles go and the bells go,
and the ferry boats are chugging right along, right along.
Up on the upper deck, the view is great by heck. You love your Galapec and you're in clover. And when the whistles blow, you hate to go below,
cause that's the signal that the fun is nearly over. On the Black Ball Ferry Line up in Seattle, every single GOP and Democrat will hear those whistles go and the bells go, as the ferry boats are chugging right along,
right along,
right along,
right along. Get aboard when the weather's fine. Take your pick of the ferries on the Black Ball Line.
There's the Illihi and the Chippewa
and the Killiute, the Kalakala.
You'll find all these on the Black Ball Line.
The Klahani,
the Nisqually,
there's the Malahat.
Well, think of that.
The Klickitat.
There goes my hat.
The S.S. City of Sacramento.
What are we doing down in California?
On the Black Ball Ferry Line, to be specific. While the whistles go and the bells go, and the ferry boats are chugging right along,
right along,
right along,
right along. Down in the engine room, the boilers hum a tune. They're singing love and boom with deep emotion.
And on the deck above, each happy pair in love is holding hands and dreaming that they own the ocean.
On the black ball ferry line up in Seattle, every single GOP and Democrat will hear the whistles go and the bells go.
And the ferry boats are chugging right along.
Right along.
Right along.
Right along. Oh, the ferry boats are chugging along.
All the ferry boats are chugging, chugging.
Ferry boats are chugging,
chugging
along.
Moved about this world of ours, and ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in Spine Chillers.
You are listening to Radio Masterpieces on Valley 104.9, serving Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge. The door is slowly closing for Radio Masterpieces, but be sure and tune in again next week from 9 to 10 p.m. to listen to more wonderful mysteries from the 1940s and 50s. This is Bruce Kaplan signing off. Radio Masterpieces is a Seattle Miracle Incorporated production.